And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And got a couple of announcements. First of all, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news and Linda Zimmerman, UFOs, more UFOs over Hudson Valley. She'll be coming up as the guest. But I do want to apologize. The first time ever I couldn't do the shows last week. That includes Monday's show because of a work commitment that was just basically around the clock. I'm still working on that same project, but I'm just about wrapping it up. So I do apologize greatly for not having a show last week. And also just a couple of changes coming up. We have the show this evening, Monday, which is very unusual because I'm going to be heading to Russia, actually, Wednesday, Thursday night. I thought my flight left on Thursday. It does indeed, but it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I have to be at JFK while the show is going on. So it's not going to happen. And it's happening tonight instead. That being said, while I'm in Russia, there's a couple of changes I just want to note. Unfortunately, I decided not to do any of the Monday night shows while I'm there just because of it's very difficult to do a show. And if you love to listen live to the show, that's going to happen at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's actually the regular time for me in Russia, but I am going to be running those during the day on YouTube. It's still going to be, the whole show is still going to be on the Dark Matter Digital Network, as usual, and that's 10 to midnight, and that's Eastern Standard Time on Thursdays. And also, it's the podcast is not going to change. The podcast UFO, everything's going to stay exactly the same. The shows will come out on Wednesdays, Thursday mornings. And so that's all staying the same. And I hope I didn't confuse everybody. I'm totally confused. Alejandro, are you confused too?
So you're going to have a show tomorrow or today that will be on tomorrow, and then in Russia there'll be a show next week that will actually be, because you're going to be flying during the normal show time
on Wednesday. Yeah.
I
don't know. I forget already. But the good news is you will be able to join live starting next week's show.
What? Me?
I think we talked about that.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
No, I think we did. You're right. And
on the 21st,
actually.
That'll be the first.
Let's do it.
All right.
So you'll be in Russia, but you've done this before where you've gone to Russia for a period of time. And it seems like your internet works pretty well, and we were able to pull it off, right?
It does. The only thing that was different is I would get up at 3:30 and start the show at 4 in the morning.
Wow.
To keep the regular time. But I was on a radio station. Now I'm not. I'm just on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So I can basically run the show when I want to, and I don't have to get up in the middle of the night.
You can do what you want.
That's right. And the podcast will not change. It's going to be just the way it always is. So, and you've been away for a week. And
I have.
Yeah, and you're relaxing, and we really don't have a whole lot of news, but you had a great time, you saw a lot of nice things, and you did not UFO at all.
No UFOing at all. Of course I would look outside and look at the skies and look around to see if I could see something unusual, and I think I said this before, is that I was going to have this a UFO-free type of thing so I can relax and just take it easy. And for the most part, that worked. Of course, I was open to any paranormal experiences. That would have been a welcome interruption to my vacation, but not really. Although my girlfriend's daughter thought she was having some ghost experiences.
Wow. In the ship itself?
No, I don't think in the ship itself, but according to, okay, so our neighbors were coming with, because their daughter is best friends with my, girlfriend's daughter. And, you know, and we're friends with the neighbors. So we decided to all do this. It was for the girls cause they just graduated from high school. So it was kind of their graduation trip. So we went over there to pick them up so we could drive out to California to go catch the cruise. And the girls were inside in just in the foyer, essentially a foyer of the house. And there's a table there. And my girlfriend walked in and, right by where, her daughter was standing, this picture just like fell off of this table onto the floor, which, you know, I'm not quite sure how that could happen. So that was kind of weird. Of course, she could have bumped it or something, but they were really freaked out and they assumed it was a ghost. And something else happened too that was weird. I can't remember that they attributed to the ghost also, but in California, because then we stayed the night before so we could catch the boat or the ship in the morning. And so that was the only potential paranormal, and they felt it was paranormal type of thing. Yeah.
Wow. See the influence you've given her? Wow. Yeah.
That's not my fault.
Hey, and no USO sightings, huh, following the ship or anything?
No, not at all. Nothing strange like that, which is kind of fine, too, because then it would have made me have to work. But, but of course, you know, and that's what's funny. You know, I've done a lot of, you know, night vision and night sky watches. I've even gone Bigfoot hunting, ghost hunting. And when you do it the first few times, it's kind of exciting because you're hoping something will happen. But once you do it like dozens of times, it's like gets to be like where you know nothing's going to happen and you want something to happen and you're prepared for something to happen. But nothing does happen. So it's always, you know, kind of you never get your expectations up. But, of course, it's exciting. It's that much more exciting when something does happen.
It's kind of like fishing over in a way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know that I've – not that I fish anymore because I'm a vegetarian. I don't like to kill the fish. But I caught a fish every time I fished, I think.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
you'd have to be pretty bad not to. But I have seen some things and had some experiences. So luckily, when it does happen, it's even that much more exciting.
Didn't you see a shadow person or something like that?
No.
In some hotel? You had something happen in a hotel?
I don't. No. Uh-uh.
In a dark hallway. Am I talking to the wrong Alejandro?
Yeah. That may be a different.
Could very well be. Wow. I gave you a perfect opportunity to fib and you didn't. How about that?
Yeah. Did you want me to?
No. Well, no. I was just trying to make the show interesting. But anyway, thanks so much. I know we don't really have any news, but it's always good to check in and say hi.
Yeah. So there you go. I've even looked for some news, you know, for the past week, a little bit since I've been back, because I've had tons of emails to go through, social media, people to talk to on, especially Facebook and stuff. So I caught up with all of that stuff. And I haven't done as much deep diving into the news as I typically do, but I will certainly, so people can go to our site and see the latest. But thus far, I haven't seen a lot. So no big UFO news even seems to have occurred while I was gone.
It waited for you.
It did. Thanks, UFOs.
And we all wait for you, too. So get back to work, and we'll see you next week.
All right. I'll have some stuff for you next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alejandro, and welcome back. And
thanks, man.
We'll be talking live next week.
Have a safe trip.
All right. Talk to you later. All right, everyone, hang in there. We'll be right back after this quick music break with Linda Zimmerman. Hey, Linda, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here
again. Yes, and kind of funny, I'm so sorry I announced the wrong name of your book. So it's More Hudson Valley
no
UFOs.
Problem.
And thank you. You sent me the book with your personal notations. That was very nice of you. And it was a real pleasure the last time you were on, and it was great meeting you. In Phoenix, I guess it was 2 years ago now, right? 2.5 years?
Yes, I think so.
Right. So for the person who hasn't heard you before, can you give a little bit of your background? And I can't remember what got you interested in the UFO topic. Was it your own sighting?
Yes, for sure. And growing up in the Hudson Valley, it just seemed to be the normal thing. Everyone had sightings.
Right.
It wasn't anything I thought I would pursue career-wise, but I started out as a research scientist for a medical diagnostics company and thought when I retired, I would start writing. And they closed the research department one day, and I said, well, let me try writing, and that was over 20 years ago. And I loved writing about weird and esoteric things, and I guess it was just inevitable that UFOs and I would get together at some point.
Yes. So the thing I hear a lot of people talk about is Pine Bush, and I know that you have some witnesses you have interviewed in your book. And basically, a lot of your book is actual personal interviews with people. Is that what it boils down to, a lot of it?
Yes, that's if you're looking for, you know, speculative ideas on UFOs and aliens, that's not so much me. I like to go to the locations, interview the eyewitnesses, get historical information where I can. And so my books are basically just cover to cover cases, actual cases.
Wow, great, great. And so let's and what inspired you to keep going after your last book that was titled UFOs? I mean, was it Hudson Valley UFOs? Is that what it was? Or
my first book was In the Night Sky.
Okay.
And that was also all Hudson Valley UFOs. Then it was Hudson Valley UFOs. And I'm running out of titles. So it became More Hudson Valley UFOs. But I thought this is my one UFO book, and I believe it was the day I got my first copies, someone contacted me with a case, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, my book is done. She said, well, you have to write another one because you need to hear my story. And when you hear that another 200-300 times, you say, okay, I need to do another book. And it's the same thing. The day this third book was completed, I got three really good cases people contacted
wow.
me with. Like, son of a, you know, here we go again. But that's what it's like being in the Hudson Valley. The wealth of information here is astounding.
Yes, I know that there was an article written, or was it a book written, that got a lot of publicity in New York for the UFOs recently. It was picked up by, I think, a couple of mainstream media.
Cheryl Acosta's book on the statistics. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, New York Times reviewed it. People are paying attention to it. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Do you feel like there is a little bit of relaxing in the media as far as UFOs go since you've started?
A little bit, but still there is the ridicule factor. For example, when they cover something about Pine Bush, you know, somebody has to make some sort of remark, something demeaning about people in tinfoil hats or something like that. So overall, I think, yes, compared to, say, the 50s, 60s, but we still have a long way to go getting respect. I'm sure you found that.
Yes. Now, what about Pine Bush again? I want to talk about that because I... A person that's helped me out with the show since just about day one lived in that area, and she recalls sitting on the side of the road in, you know, beach chairs, waiting at night with a whole bunch of people. Does anything like that still go on?
Well, not to that degree. Just 2 weeks ago, I did a bit of a sky watch with a friend of mine who runs the Pine Bush Archive. And we were sitting there, and a big pickup truck comes rumbling by, and we're still in farm country, and are like, uh-oh, what kind of harassment are we going to get? And a woman rolls down her window, are you UFO hunting? Are you, you know, sky watching? And we're like, maybe. You know, why do you want to know? And she says, oh, let me tell you about my sighting. So she comes over, and just 2 years ago, she said a massive orange orb, she called it a round craft, went silently over her house. And she said she was astounded. She you know, this was the first time she'd lived there for many years. And the kicker was, she said, you know, I didn't grow up here. She grew up in Pennsylvania. She said it's a small town, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called Kecksburg. You never know who and what you will meet on the streets of Pine Bush. But the heydays in the 80s and 90s, when hundreds of people would line the streets, they're gone basically because it's been so developed mm-hmm. now. The big houses lining the streets, and you can't just park on somebody's property and set up a lawn chair, unfortunately.
Right, right. Now, I've talked to people like Mark D'Antonio, and who's actually, you know, setting up. I'm not sure. Did you get to meet Mark? Was he there? He was there, wasn't he, the same time you were there?
Mark was there at the Pine Bush UFO Festival last month. Yes, I did.
I've talked to him about, you know, setting up this UFOTOG, you know, detection units mm-hmm. and hotspots, and it seems like that has got to be one of the areas they must be considering.
I would think it would be one of their first considerations in the Northeast. They're still wide open fields that if they could get permission, there are spots where you have 360-degree views, and I think that would be a great location.
Now, I know that off the shore of Long Island, there was a bunch of film sightings that turned out to be just airliners, you know, coming into JFK or something like that. But are any of these sightings in the Pine Bush area, for instance, since we're talking about that, have any of them been explained, or are they just all, you know, a mystery?
Well, we do have Stewart Airport 10 minutes away, and a lot of traffic comes into that airport, and some small regional ones. And, of course, we're in the New York metro area. So usually within the first 10 or 15 minutes, if you're doing a sky watch, you can identify the paths that most of the airlines are taking. Mm-hmm. Certainly that has been some of it. Wishful thinking that you're seeing a UFO coming in for a landing and it's going to Stewart. But the sightings go back to the 1920s. And the nature of the sightings, it's very unique in Pine Bush. A lot of the activity comes up out of the ground and back into the ground. People have seen craft they described as like Ferris wheels spiraling, coming up out of the woods, out of the ground, lights coming up and out. And it's very unusual, the sounds you hear from the ground as well, like there's machinery under your feet. It's really, it's worth it to go and visit and see for yourself.
Wow, that is really crazy, huh? And what about yourself? Have you actually seen something in that particular area?
We did a sky watch, I'd say, about 2 years ago. And there was an object moving. It was still evening. It was still light. And I had a pair of binoculars and put the binoculars, and I thought I'd be identifying an aircraft. It was small, round, wingless, and moving very fast under the clouds. I was trying to think perhaps some sort of drone. You know, we have West Point Military Academy, and there is a military presence still at Stewart, but I don't know of any wingless round drones at this point. And we also, you get a strobe light effect there. And that same night, just as I'm thinking, well, nothing's going to happen, this strobe light went off like a camera flash. And we had no idea where it had come from. And I checked the weather forecast, the radar map, and the nearest lightning strikes were over 70 miles away. Wow. So I don't know how to explain that as well. So things are still happening in Pine Bush, mostly rectangular craft in the last few years.
Rectangular? Hearing, it seems like all the time I'm hearing about, the triangular, but never, very, very rarely do you hear about, rectangular. I mean, a friend of mine had a rectangular sighting and, that looked like a box. But can you describe what they're seeing?
They're seeing something longer than it is wide, a rectangle, generally a white light in each corner and a red light in the center. And I've had numerous reports of this over, I'd say, the last 5 years. Again, like the massive triangles, they're silent, generally dark black or gunmetal. One woman described something very interesting. She said it looked like the bottom of a glass-bottom boat. Mm. As if there was some sort of projection or rippling to the bottom of it. And one other person described that they could see the stars almost as if they were being projected on the bottom for some sort of stealth or invisibility. Wow. But they knew the star patterns didn't look quite right. They were being projected, but a little distortion.
So they screwed up a little.
They screwed up a little, exactly. And we always like to try to exploit the screw-ups.
Especially when they can do so much, right? Yeah. Now, this woman that contacted you when you finished your last book and said, wait a minute, you have to write another book. You have to write about my sighting. Did she make the cut? Is she in the book?
She's in the second book.
She's made in the second book.
And yes, and the majority of the stories I get are fascinating, and I follow up as much as possible. There are that percentage that, I saw a light in the sky. Okay, I can't do much with, I can't do much with that. And some people they just don't sound reliable. But the majority of people are just honest, sincere people who saw something they can't explain, and they just want to share it with people.
Wow, that's great. So let's, in the notations that you sent me, let's start off the bat. I want to talk right off the bat about your favorite witness, Victoria Lama. So however you say her name. Can you tell us, I mean, didn't she work with the FAA, right?
She was a professional plane spotter, which I didn't know existed. She worked for many years for LaGuardia Airport, you know, a major New York airport. And her job was to match tail numbers with the type of aircraft it was supposed to be with what the transponders were telling you. And I said, why would you do that? Well, because drug dealers and other criminals will steal a plane, alter the tail number, and then think they can just fly into a major airport, New York airport, and no one will notice. So she was trained to identify jets, small planes, helicopters of civilian, military, and commercial. This was what she did for a living. And a couple of years later, she was working at Westchester County Airport, living in that area. She's on her way home with her mother, and she looks up, and there's a craft so huge and so low, she can't see from side to side. She can't even tell what shape it is. Yeah. She said she was doing her best to, did it say U.S. Air Force on it or property of, you know, United States? No markings, two lines of lights, one red, one white, but about 60 feet off the ground and just filled the sky. She gets out of the car. Her mother's yelling hysterically. Other people are pulling over. They're all yelling hysterically. She races home and calls her friend, who's one of the radar men at this Westchester County airport. And he says, we have it on radar. I have no idea what it is. It's enormous. He's really excited. He said, you know, we'll talk about this tomorrow. So she sees it for quite a while. In fact, this thing is hovering over her yard for several minutes. Next morning, she's pulling into the parking lot, and this radar man is running around the parking lot. She's like, what's wrong with this guy? He runs over to the car, and first thing he says, whatever you do, if you want to keep your job, you didn't see anything. It was a flock of birds.
My God.
She's like, what are you saying? Why are you saying this? Right after their conversation on the phone, military men with guns drawn burst into the radar room, into the tower, knocked over a table, knocking things over, were very intimidating, and in no uncertain terms said, if you people want to keep working here, it was a flock of birds. And that's where they had to end it. So when a woman whose job is to identify aircraft can't even tell me the shape of it because it was so huge, so low, and then she's threatened with her job. So I asked her, could it have been something military? And apparently the military men had it on their radar because there was an Air National Guard station at the airport at that time. They had seen it on their radar. That's why they rushed over to the civilian part of the airport and said, this is not ours, but you are not to talk about it.
So this is actually one other thread of that you hear about cover-up. I mean, this is plainly a cover-up. And just out of speculation, why do you think they would cover it up if it wasn't theirs? What do you think is involved in that? Do you think that the military doesn't know what these things are, but they don't want people to be afraid, or do you think they know more?
Well, I think they have to know more. You know, with the radar systems we've had for so many decades, they have to know what's coming in and out of our own airspace. My theory is, the whole idea of government and military is power. And if you admit there is something you are completely powerless in the face of, how does that make you look? You lose your status, your credibility, your sway over the population. There could be a lot more to it, but as far as I can tell, that's probably the main thing.
Do you think that in that particular case that some part of a country may communicate with another part of another country, you know, along those lines about these things, like someone is talking about it between countries? Or do you think that each country just kind of, you know, keeps their sightings under their own lid type of thing?
I would think countries would talk to one another. Here, at least, I would think we're in communication with Mexico and Canada, as so many sightings have crossed, you know, both airspaces or all three. I think it would behoove us to keep on top of things and want to know what's going on in the rest of the world. Again, I have no insider knowledge of secret groups, but it would just seem to make sense. There is definitely something going on. We need as much information about it as we can. But that's me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously, they're not a danger. Otherwise, we'd know it by now. And so that's all part of the equation of everything, I think. But, yeah, it's interesting to speculate on this whole theory, like who knows what part of the government does know, and how, you know, compartmentalized is it, you know?
Well, sure. Well, there was a case at Stewart Airport used to be Stewart Air Force Base, and they had a huge, enormous square building called the Sage Building. Semi-automated ground environment. I don't know why I remember that, but it was basically part of the Strategic Air Command, and they watched everything coming in and out of our airspace. And in the early 60s, he said everybody was, you know, freaking out basically because something came from the southern part of the country racing at an unbelievably fast speed up the East Coast. Everybody saw it. They knew from the speed and the way this thing was moving, it was not ours. It was not the Russians. And he said everybody was buzzing about that for months. And when you figure somebody who's in the chain of having your finger on the nuclear button is really agitated and excited, that is big news. So they had to, you know, they had to know going back many, many decades, there are things out there beyond their control.
Don't you find it kind of unusual that, you know, all the military people connected, say, for instance, the people that burst into the radar room there, you know, with the guns drawn and all that, don't you think that if, you know, they retire down the line or whatever, that there may be some loose lips, or do you think people were really, you know, threatened, or, you know, have to really abide by their, you know, classification to keep their pension or whatever it is? Or do you ever think about any of that?
I have spoken to people who say it is still loyalty. I have spoken to other people who did mention pensions. They don't want to do anything to risk that. But I have had some military men speak to me in the area. There was a great case in this latest book from 1966 from the West Point Military Academy. And I actually spoke to the retired colonel. I believe he was a captain at the time. But all the cadets and instructors are streaming out of the buildings looking up because there's this massive classic flying saucer shape flying low over the buildings. And the MPs were flooded with calls. The whole base knew about this. And I said, you know, did you, he actually followed it down to the river. I said, did you talk about it with everyone? He, you know, not ideal for career advancement. and he would talk about it with me today, but under the agreement that I would not reveal his name, because there's still that apprehension. Could they do something to him? I don't know that they would at this point for a sighting like that, but still, why risk it? What's to be gained?
Right. Wow. So let's talk about a couple of other people that you found really interesting in your book on, that you interviewed.
Oh, so many.
I'll pick some out if that's all right.
Sure. Yes. Go ahead.
Let's see. There was, you're in your own book, aren't you?
Yes, unfortunately.
So we'll get to that in a minute.
Yes,
I saw in here there were some drawings. Said, let's just, for instance, talk about this really strange one, which is it Ed? Is that his name? Ed, and I'm just trying to see where he's from. It's toward the end of the book. There's a drawing on a paper plate in 1974.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that was fascinating. I was, anytime I give a lecture in the Hudson Valley, I usually get at least a dozen people coming up to me afterwards to share their stories. And his story was just stunning and something I had never heard anything like it before. He was on the west side of the Hudson River, and at that point, he could see across to the city of Poughkeepsie, which is not far. And he said this light came down and it resolved into, the only thing he could describe is it looked like a mountain in the sky. It looked like it was actually made of rock. And on the bottom of it was some sort of lighted craft as if it was attached. He said it looked like it could detach from this enormous rock, and they watched it for many minutes. He couldn't estimate the size, but he said it was just enormous. And, a picture is worth 1,000 words, so I said, could you sketch it for me? So over on the refreshment table, he grabbed a paper plate and sketched this huge mountain shape with the craft under it. And, I said, I will take evidence any way I can get it. And this craft, as enormous as it was, moved away very rapidly. And he and several friends saw it. And maybe some of your listeners have heard of something like this, but I have never heard of something that looked like an actual mountain of rock in the sky. That was a new one.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything like that. And you talked earlier about the vibrations and noises that people heard underground. That's back in Pine Bush, going back to that. Can you describe more of what that was like? Is it like almost like an earthquake or anything?
Some people kind of describe it as a tremor, an earthquake, but mostly a hum or a vibration. What I hear most often is if someone was doing construction underground, the sound at a construction site, only if that was beneath your feet under the ground, which I don't know how to explain that. But I recently also got an email from a woman who said that she was one of those early West Searsville Road and Pine Bush sky watchers, where the hundreds of people would gather. And she said she's standing there one night, and up out of the ground, she said, came a swirl of electricity, of energy. She said it almost looked like the rings of Saturn. And half a block away, it lit up a tree like daylight, and then it faded back into the ground. She said she ran towards it. That's a true sky watcher. You run towards these things.
Brave one.
As fast as she could. And by the time she got to the ground, the rings were gone. But she said, you know, the 4th of July sparklers, it was like these sparklers were leaping out of the ground. Jeez. And then it all faded and nothing was there.
Did they?
But that's what I'm.
Wow. In a case like that, you would think that someone would test the ground area to see what they could come up with. Do you know if anyone has done anything like that?
People have done electromagnetic tests and found there are unusual fields in the area, which may be from the geology or underground water sources. I don't know. But they definitely have found there's anomalous, normal, we don't call it normal, anomalous energies are in the ground at Pine Bush for sure.
Wow, that is really, really interesting. So let's talk about Barbara at West Point Military Academy back in 1966, that case.
That was the one I was mentioning.
Oh, okay.
Barbara's father was the colonel, but it was fascinating to hear the start of the story. She and her mother, you know, they were stationed at the base, are walking across a courtyard between buildings. And she's just a little kid, and all of a sudden, all these men in uniforms are rushing out, pointing up to the sky. And you know, she didn't know what was going on at first, and then they all looked up, and that's when they saw the enormous disc. And the mother later called the MPs, and he said it had been reported up and down the Hudson River that day. Those were his words. Uh-huh. So that's pretty interesting when the military police state something like that and also said they had been swamped with calls on the base that day.
Going back to the radar signals or data, you mentioned that the person said that it was huge. Can they actually tell how big something is through radar, or is it just like approximate?
I'm not sure how detailed they can get. I'm sure with modern radar, it can be a lot more. This was 1983, so I'm not a radar expert, but I'm sure you could tell the difference between a jumbo jet and a small plane by the size of the blip, you know. But he clearly said it was an enormous, huge object. Mm-hmm. So he had that capacity.
Right. And do you have, when you're researching for your book, how do you go about that? Do you start out with, you know, a lot of people used to start out with microfiche and look for cases. How do you actually do that besides people contacting you?
Other than that, yes, I spend a lot of hours getting seasick, watching microfiche go by. But lot of online newspaper searches as well. And that's one of the things that has really caught my attention is the wave of sightings I found in the Hudson Valley and in the Northeast from 1908 to 1910. And I've found countless articles from the Hudson Valley, from Boston, from Canada, throughout this area, people were seeing at night an enormous, dark, cigar-shaped object with one to three lights. It could go up to an altitude estimated at least 1,500 feet, which is a key number because Wilbur Wright in 1908 set an altitude record of 361 feet.
Right. Yeah.
That's as high anyone had gotten in a plane. So 1,500 feet at night. No planes were flying at night. Many of the reporters, I have to hand it to them, they really did their due diligence. When there was a sighting, they would go around to anybody who might have a dirigible or a balloon, and they would report every balloon has been accounted for. And so you knew there was no man-made craft. But no one was hysterical. No one thought it was people from Venus or Mars. They thought it was somebody like the Wright brothers or Thomas Edison. They kept saying the genius inventor who has invented something that can hover, move at an incredibly rapid rate, can fly at night, can carry enormous searchlights. And they often described it was like they were searching for something. And could go one night. One was seen from New York to Boston, and nothing was flying that distance, as I said, at night. And this went on for a couple of years. So I've spent a lot of time in newspaper archives looking for cases like that, searching APRO files, Project Blue Book files, because there's still a lot of untapped cases and information in Blue Book, for sure.
Wow. I am always fascinated by the early cases, especially when, you know, there's the saying out there that the modern UFO age, you know, there were no sightings before 47. That's what you hear a lot, which is, you know, baloney.
Exactly.
And, Linda, we're losing you to the dark. You're going to have to turning.
Okay.
You're going to have to turn on some type of light there.
I can turn a
yeah,
light on
good.
Now. Is that too glaring?
No, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I'm so used to working in the dark, I don't notice anymore.
Pretty funny. So I want to talk about, you wrote an article about dogs and UFOs, and I found that I'm a real dog lover. I want to hear about that, the inspiration and about that.
Sure. Well, I was looking at Open Minds. I love Alejandro Rojas's news on your show, and also, you know, his news he posts on the website. And I saw this interesting case about where a deer seemed to be noticing the UFO. Mm-hmm. And I love these animal reaction cases. And I said, you know, I've dealt with a lot of cases where dogs seem to have noticed something along with the owners. But the dogs usually see or sense something first. They'll start whining or barking, won't want to go outside. There was a great case where this dog, very, very agitated. So the owner's trying to push him out the back door, and he used to love to go out. But he pushes him out the back door, and the dog curls up in the ball and is terrified. And the owner suddenly realizes the entire sky is blacked out from a giant triangle. And so the dog sensed something. And so what I did in this article is gathered several of those cases. And it made me think, we know dogs have superior hearing, especially in the high range.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe a part of our UFO hunting equipment should be audio equipment that can hear in the ranges that a dog can hear.
That's right. Well, I forget what the percentage is, but we can only see so much around us, and we can only hear so much around us, and there can be a lot of things going on that they're out of our ranges. So,
exactly.
You know, especially when it comes to vision, you know, and night, you know, night vision too, you know, all that. But mm-hmm. there's still a lot of waves where we can't detect us through our eyes and other senses. So, and, mm-hmm. you know, you talk about this thing coming out of the ground and going back into the ground and all that, and the vibration and all that. And it starts to make me wonder about what some people think could be another dimension type of thing. Has anyone ever talked about that, or is that too far out?
I'm open to the possibilities. Obviously, I have no proof of that. But from the things people have been describing, another dimension would certainly help to explain these things. Objects suddenly appearing, several cases where it seemed as though the craft went into a slit, people would describe like a slit in the sky, or would shrink to a point.
Mm-hmm.
Things that, you know, our modern physics, our everyday physics, let's say, would have a hard time explaining, for sure.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you talked about lights in the sky. Is that, would you say that's, I know that's the majority of a lot of sightings. Is that what you would say also happens in New York, is mostly lights, and then the really good cases come after that?
I was surprised. I thought the bulk of what people would tell me would be lights in the sky, and it's actually not a really big percentage. I was stunned how many people had sightings within 100 or 200 feet. Prolonged sightings, missing time, if you want to get into that. Very, very close encounters, seeing things hovering over their car, looking through, you know, seeing the light coming out of the windows of these craft and picking out details. They were so close. And I can't say this happens everywhere in the world, but the Hudson Valley, it's very up close and personal in a, I would say, even a majority of the cases. Of course, there's the, oh, I saw something flying by, but that was the thing about the wave in the 1980s when the massive triangular craft were coming by. They were at treetop level, which I heard time and time again. I had people tell me they could hit it with a baseball. If they had a rock, they could have hit it. They could have hit it with a tennis ball. In other words, it was so close that it could not be mistaken for anything else.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. How do you think the average person, do you think the average person just gets over something like that, or do you think they carry it with them?
No. Yeah, no. Getting over it is not something, when it's an intense sighting, that is not something that, that happens. In fact, part of my fascination was I wanted to see 20, 30 years later, how did these people who had these intense sightings handle it? How did it change their lives? And for the most part, these were life-altering experiences. And, you know, they're grown up and have children now, or senior citizens, and, you know, decades on from their experience. And I'll tell you, I wish I had a dollar for every time someone said, I remember it like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And many people said it opened them up to new possibilities. They became more spiritual, more tolerant. But there is a significant percentage of people who are still living in fear. One woman in particular said she is still terrified to bring the garbage out at night. She won't do it unless someone turns on the light and goes out with her. So I don't want to diminish the impact, trivialize this at all. This can be extremely traumatic and terrify people for the rest of their lives as well.
Yes. On my sighting I had, there was never, I never felt threatened, but I could understand how someone could feel threatened, especially when you're talking about these cases where it's like right over, you know, right over the car or whatever. Boy, I'll tell you, that would be scary when you just felt like you had no way out. So let's talk about, you mentioned missing time cases. Can you talk about some of those?
Yes, just, and I will segue into my own.
Okay, good.
As well at the end of that. But people who are driving to a destination. This one woman, she was, you know, an older woman, very active in the community, and was very strict about her punctuality. And she was on her way to, I think it was a ladies' auxiliary meeting in town. I believe this was Carmel area. And she saw this craft, absolutely fascinated, came very low. She thought this was a 1 or 2 minute sighting. Gets to the meeting, and everybody's like, are you all right? She's like, what are you talking about? Well, we started 45 minutes ago. She's like, no, that's just not possible. Other cases where you're just going about your business and you realize it's an hour later and you don't know anything of what happened. But for the most part, the missing time is people seeing something very close, thinking the activity, the sighting was brief or a minute or two, and losing sometimes hours of time. I've had many people say the next thing they know, they wake up, it's morning, and they're in their driveway, and they have no idea how they got there. And in addition to that, they may lose, they have no idea of what happened, and maybe in a year, maybe 10 years, maybe it'll all come back to them. There was a fascinating case from the early 60s. A family was driving home from the movies, and a massive craft stopped in the road in front of them. And I love this description. The little girl went down on the back floor. She was so scared. And she said there was this strange energy, and she watched the carpet fibers rise up. All the carpet fibers rose up as if there was some sort of static electricity. Wow. And the whole, yeah, I get goosebumps just thinking of that. And the next thing they know, they're getting home, and the grandmother's like, "What took you so long?" And they're like, "What do you mean?" They all forgot about it. 20 years later, they're all sitting down to Thanksgiving dinner, and suddenly one of them says, "Remember what we saw when we were coming back from the movies that night?" And just like that, all of the family members remembered at once.
Wow.
It was like a switch went off, and I find this time and again. A woman I just interviewed, she couldn't remember anything. She was camping one night, and she thought these little woodland creatures, deer or something, were coming near to her. And she realized they were short people with very large eyes, and her girlfriend saw the same thing. And it wasn't until 2 years later that they both remembered at the same time. And it's like there's a time delay, some sort of fuse on these experiences that maybe it's gone forever, but maybe years from now you'll spontaneously recall all the details.
Interesting. Yes, I've heard of a number of cases where people will either have a sighting and be together with a bunch of people and they don't even talk about it. And then they'll talk about it in like years later. You know, they won't talk about it the next day or anything like that, but years later it'll come back as a memory many, many times. And, you know, maybe that is, let's say that somehow there is an abduction or something, and they're blocking out the time, also the memories. Perhaps maybe it only lasts for so long, or, you know, I mean, I guess that's what regression hypnosis can sometimes pull that up if that's what it is. But let's hear.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah.
No. I was going to say I want to hear about your own situation.
Oh, okay. I had written in the first book about a sighting I had very briefly. Three lights were moving over my neighborhood. And we jumped in the car, and I thought we followed it up to this state park, Harriman State Park. And we watched it, and it was fascinating. These three lights came together in a burst of bright light, and as one glowing object lowered to the top of this mountain. At this point, a state trooper pulls up, and he's like, you know, I had run out of the door in my bathrobe, so I'm in the bathrobe with, you know, a couple of people in the middle of a state park at night. So I didn't want to sound completely crazy, but I said, just turn around and look. And he saw this glowing object on the top of the mountain. He said, get out of here now. And we did. And in fact, he blew by us. He was so terrified.
Remember this, yeah.
So I've been telling this story. I thought I knew every minute of that night because it was the most remarkable thing I've seen in my entire life. No question about it. And last, I think October, I said, you know, I used to keep a diary. Let me see. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. I said, here I am being a UFO historian, and I don't know the date of my own sighting. So one day I just sat there going through page after page, which is very weird going through your life 35 years ago. And I come across the date, December 9th, 1979, and I'm reading my own handwriting, and it talks about how we jumped in the car and went to this reservoir, and I stood there for an hour with a pair of binoculars looking at this craft zipping in one direction, stopping, going back and forth, and we watched this for an hour. And it was like reading the handwriting of a stranger, because I was like, no, that I never went to the reservoir that night. That didn't, why did I write this? Whoa. So I was with my ex-boyfriend that night, so I called him up. I said, do you remember that night? He said, oh, yeah, vividly. And I said, did we go to this reservoir? He said, you know, I remember going to the reservoir, but I have no recollection of what happened after that. And I'm like, oh, no, don't tell me that. Yet one of our group does remember some of that night. Then the next night, we apparently went back to this state park. Watched, I said, saw more of the strange things. I knew they would be there. I'm like, how did I know they would be there? I wrote all this stuff and then promptly forgot it. And it, had I not written that down, I wouldn't have known that happened. And I have tried and tried, you know, let me relax and bring myself back to that time.
Well, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. This is the last time I'm going to be on American soil for a few months, so I'll be back in August. Remember, you can listen to the show live at 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on YouTube, or just go to our website, podcastufo.com. It's right there. That's if you want to listen to the whole show. If you want to support the show and listen to it as a podcast, all you have to do is give us $2 or more per month. All that information is on our website. Thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.